welcome Grace Bergen, our newest commissioner, and I was just reviewing some of her information and background, and she is amazing, and she also represents the real estate industry, is in leadership roles, both at the local and state level, and just has a wonderful background in Springfield. Maybe you could just spend a couple of minutes and just give us a sense of your thoughts about the Planning Commission and why you see this as a vital role.
Sure. Hello, everyone. I think I've met all of you, most of you.
Yeah, not me. Yeah. I was not there at the City Council meeting that you were confirmed.
Okay.
I'm Leonard Stair. I'm a City Councilor in Ward 4.
Well, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I am, as you had mentioned, I am in real estate. I have been for about 5.5 years and involved with the local, state, and national level. And a lot of what's been, in fact, last week we were just up at the state capitol at our spring governance meeting talking about homeownership and whatnot. It's that legislation that always trying to take benefits of that away. And so I do advocate for homeowners and myself being a homeowner at the state and national level as well. And one of the things about Planning Commission that really interested in me, is there's a course that I took a couple years ago, and those of you who have heard my interview probably heard about this, Smart Growth for the 21st Century, that's put on by the National Association of Realtors. And I'm actually working to see if we can get something like that into Springfield, whether that's the city or just with the Realtor organization. I think the things that they talked about are a lot of the things that you guys talked about on this commission about potentially mixed use buildings, different land use issues. And when I took that course, I really realized that real estate professionals need to have a seat at the table anytime that stuff is being discussed, in my opinion. Because we are in the need of that every day. And I found that I do have a passion for it. So I've had a couple of local government affairs directors that have been pushing me to this role because my plate isn't full enough. And so here I am. I'm excited and honored to serve with you guys.
Excellent. Nice. Okay. All right. Well, always around this time of the year, or often around this time of the year, or at least once a year, especially when we have a new planning commissioner, we have our legal counsel, Christina, review with us the ethics law and regulation that governs us as public officials. So being said, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah.
So I've got two handouts for you tonight that Brenda printed out. The first is the ethics training cheat sheet. And Greg noted the title, the irony in the title of this. I inherited the title, but the from my predecessor, but the irony is not lost on me. So this is your high-level overview of the things that I think are the most important, and then there are some resources attached. There's no, I noticed there's a little bit of a typo under the contact info. Somehow when I added my email address, it did not take out Lauren King's, which was prior to me. So don't email lak@emeraldlaw.com because that won't get you anywhere. And then for, I think most of you are aware, but Mary Bridget and I are going to be going in-house as in-house city attorneys starting July 1. So we will have new contact information then, and we'll provide that to you as soon as we know what those
as opposed to out-house attorneys?
as opposed to on a retainer with our law firm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We got plenty of those.
Hopefully that's not hopefully that's not how you think of us now, but either way, it'll be rectified in July. So we will be, just for general information, we'll be right across from Development and Public Works. There's a frosted glass door there that'll become the city attorney's office. I think they'll replace it with clear glass instead of the frosted. But if for any reason you need to visit us, that's where we'll be. We're pretty excited. So the second thing tonight is this longer ethics and standards of conduct outline. And this has a lot more comprehensive information. in it. It's the same as you would have received if you were here for the training we did in 2016. Both of these are actually the same. The laws haven't changed. And last time we did this training, we went through some hypos, some hypothetical examples. I thought tonight instead I wanted to focus on a topic that we didn't focus on last night that I think I've noticed just causing more, it's been in the news a lot more, and it's come up with the Planning Commission more, which is public meetings and public records law and just how to navigate those, because it's something that we are seeing more change in and more attention to in the, at the legislature, especially after the Kitzhaber, that situation, the legislature is really focused in on public, you know, basically sunshine laws, public record, access to public records, public meetings. Locally, there's been a long ongoing controversy around the Lane County Board of Commissioners, alleged attempts to skirt the public meetings law, and so it's something that our local news media and local citizens are pay more attention to than maybe some other jurisdictions. So I want to make sure that you guys are well equipped to know what's appropriate and what's, you know, we'd recommend staying away from. So we'll start with just the basic ethics overview, and then we'll talk more about public meetings and records.
Just before you get into this, just a statement. We are each, as public officials, accountable for our own conduct, our own ethical conduct. I mean, if we were to do something that was unethical, we could be held personally liable and responsible for that. Is that true?
Yes, and that was going to be my first.
Oh, good.
That was going to be my first statement. So, you are all public officials, and so these Oregon government ethics law applies to you personally. It's not, there are situations in which if you approved a zoning application and then it later turned out that that zone change was on landslide area and there was a massive landslide, unfortunately, and people's houses were damaged, you as public officials would be insulated from that liability because you were acting in the scope of your duties. The government ethics law is not one of those situations where you get to claim I'm acting as a public official, the city's really responsible, it's not me as an individual. You are individually responsible for your ethics. And I certainly, our office gives advice and tries to help to the maximum extent that we can, but if you ever find yourself with a real conflict, it's something that you would want to get your own personal legal advice on, because, you know, I represent the city and the city's best interests, and no planning commissioner or city councilor personally, and that's the same advice that we give to the city council as well. So, you know, the other thing is that the ethics law and your personal ethics may be different things. So you may personally have a standard of conduct that you want to hold yourself to that isn't covered by the ethics law. Or you might personally think that there should be some wiggle room on something and it's really not, doesn't seem like a bad idea to you because of all the facts and situations, but these laws are construed really strictly. So your personal ethics and the ethics laws might not always overlap. I don't have a lot of worries about that from this group, but we give the same training no matter what.
And governed by the Oregon Ethics Commission.
Yes, the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And if you ever got into, they've been in the news more with the Kitzhaber. They it levied a pretty substantial fine against him. So there's a whole process. If you were ever in trouble with the Ethics Commission, there's a whole process that goes through. And so that would be a situation, though, where we'd be helping refer you to some outside legal counsel if that was if you got into hot water. They provide a lot of resources to try to help people stay out of hot water. And those are listed, I think, on the last page of this cheat sheet. So they have a guide for public officials that has even more information than I've outlined. And they keep that pretty up to date. It's the very first resource. And then the commission also publishes opinions. So if you have a particular situation that you're wondering, can I use, none of you are going to be flying on the part of the Planning Commission, but if you were flying on for city business and you wanted to know if you could use the frequent flyer miles that you've earned as part of that, whether you could use those for your family vacation to Disneyland, you know, there's probably an ethics opinion on point that might give you some of that information. So those are searchable, and they're online at that website that you see there. The main, and you are all, like I said, you're all public officials.
Tim, did you have a question?
Yeah.
In reference to what you were just stating about situations where you might need legal assistance, you're saying that the city attorney's office would provide legal assistance as opposed to you having your own legal
If you have a question about the ethics law, then we can generally help give you information, but it's but we would refer you, like if you got into hot in if you personally were in trouble,
this
somehow,
is all hypothetical.
We would give you references for attorneys in the community that would assist you personally.
What I'm saying is that you may have your own attorney to begin with, but that is not an option. The option would be
could have your own attorney. I'm just saying our office could help you find one if you didn't have one.
Okay. I thought it sounded like you were pushing people certain direction.
Just that we wouldn't say, well, you're out of luck, we can't help you. We would say, here's somebody that might be good for you.
Okay.
We could not represent you, is the gist. If you have if some of you may have your own attorneys from your professional life, and that would be another option too.
Okay.
So the main thing to pay attention to is no financial gain from your service as a public official. So it's a but-for standard. So but for your role as a planning commissioner, if you would have a financial gain or avoid a financial detriment, or a relative that's named in the under the law certain relatives count, or a business of yours or that relative's would have a gain or avoid a detriment, then that's what's a prohibited conflict of interest. So there are two kinds of conflicts of interests, and those are actual and potential, and we've covered this, I think, the last training, and most of you were here for that, and I know Grace and I covered this in her orientation. An actual conflict of interest is when you know for certain that it would impact you in a way that's different than a member of the general public. So obviously, if you guys are voting on the development code as applies to every property owner, then that's something that's generally the same for every citizen. So that could be a situation. So if you know of something there, that's more likely to be a potential conflict of interest. Like I could buy property tomorrow that would be subject to this, and that level of being out there, like you don't currently own property, but you could buy property in Springfield just like anybody else could, and then it would be subject to these development code changes. That's not really, doesn't get into it, but I own property in this master plan area. That's an actual conflict of interest. And so actual conflicts of interest, you have to declare publicly that you have a conflict, and then you cannot participate in that decision or in that vote. If you have something that's a potential conflict of interest, then you need to declare that it could potentially arise. I always recommend that you declare whether or not you have any personal bias. And then obviously if you have a personal bias and it's quasi-judicial, you would not participate. But in legislative actions, usually you want to keep an open mind and act without bias, but legislative is a little bit of a different context in terms of you might have your own opinions about marijuana regulations, in the development code that you come into it with, and that's perfectly acceptable. But so you declare those, and then you can still participate in the voting and the discussion of the potential conflict of interest if it's something you feel comfortable with. There are situations in which people have recused themselves. I think recently Joe Piscinari had a potential conflict of interest with some of the accessory dwelling unit standards because he has an interest in developing accessory dwelling units personally, and he recused himself from those conversations. We've had other recent things before the Planning Commission where maybe one of your employers had an application come before the Planning Commission on a development that's completely unrelated to your job, and so you would announce that that could be seen as a potential conflict of interest, but not recuse yourselves because
to recuse myself on that.
And then you have
while I'm a lane.
Yeah, and then you recuse yourself. So those are sort of personal judgments. You can decide to recuse yourself on a potential conflict of interest, but you're not required to. But if you have an actual conflict of interest, you know that something would affect your interests or your business or your relatives, then you must recuse yourself. You should have all just recently done your annual verified statement of economic interest. so I hope that went smoothly. I think the deadline for that was yesterday. Is that right?
Sunday.
It was Sunday. Okay. So if you haven't done that, let us know.
That brings up a question.
Yeah.
I know Amy oversees the city of Springfield's compliance with that, and I know that she's basically telling people that have problems with it just to call the Ethics Commission because she's over, I mean, everybody's having problems with it.
Okay.
And so, does the city attorney's office have any role at all in that process?
No. I don't file one because I am currently not.
No, I don't mean that.
Yeah.
But I mean.
But I'm saying, like, I don't even have an account to get into the system to see what it looks
like. Well, I don't mean personally, but I mean, as far as legally overseeing the process.
We don't play any, so we don't get that communication. We don't, the state communicates to the city recorder who needs to file one, and then they send it out. If you have questions about what you have to disclose under the law in that statement, then we could help.
I've got their phone number, so I've called them a number of times.
It's really between you and them. Yeah. We're just kind of an agent.
Because the main question I have is at what point are they going to smooth out their system to where you can actually use
it? And I wouldn't know that at all.
I think last year was the first year with the new system.
Well, this has been the third year.
The first year,
they admitted they had everything all messed up.
Yeah.
And then hopefully in the succeeding years, they're going to smooth it out. But so far, they haven't because I talked to them, and they said there's hundreds and hundreds of people that can't even get into their system.
Yeah.
To their credit, though, they're quite helpful.
Well, yeah, they are, because I do everything verbally because I can't get into their system. And so I say, when are you going to smooth it out? And they said, well, it's all dictated by the legislature. So.
Oh, if they don't get funding, it's probably funding related.
So, and Grace, you don't have to worry about that this year. Next year you will.
I already did mine.
Oh, okay. For real estate? Mm. Oh, okay.
She was appointed as of.
Oh, okay.
So it would have applied to her. Okay. If you're appointed on that day, you're supposed to file one. So.
Good.
So we can answer, if you have questions about that, like, you know, what types of things am I supposed to be, like, how far, you know, what do these things extend to, then we can try to help point you towards answers there. Again, as a representative of the city, legally, and not any of you personally. The longer manual has some information about tort claims and litigation. If the city were to be sued or the planning commission were to be named in a lawsuit or you as a planning commissioner named in a lawsuit, what would your liability be? And how would the city, you know, defend you in those? And if you're acting within the scope of your, again, not ethics related, but making planning decisions, if you're acting in the scope of your role as a planning commissioner, then you're pretty much shielded from that liability. Sometimes defamation has come up, especially if you have really contentious public hearings and you might make a statement to the newspaper about a particular applicant in theory or a particular development. There's some information on how to avoid a potential defamation lawsuit. And then, so public meetings and public records. This is what I primarily wanted to talk about tonight since I think we didn't focus on this as much last year. So the law requires public meetings to be made public. And it prohibits meeting in private. And the Oregon courts have done this interesting thing where they've said that meeting and to meet are not the same thing, that they mean different things. And basically the gist of it is that you can essentially illegally meet even if there's no meeting
face-to-face.
Yeah, there's no physical assembly of people. So the Oregon Court of Appeals, it was the Lane County decision with Commissioner Rob Tandy. He and some other commissioners essentially were accused of having serial conversations and emails. So one commissioner talking to or calling another commissioner, following up via email, that commissioner following up via email to the county administrator and another commissioner, and etc. And the crux of it, that the Court of Appeals said that that type of arrangement can violate the public meetings law, which the requirement is that any time you have a quorum of a public body, the Planning Commission is a public body, and a quorum of you is four of you, anytime you have a quorum of a public body deliberating or deciding towards a decision that you make in your role, that if that happens outside of a public meeting context, it's a violation.
So three of the commissioners would not be a violation?
No, but what we really caution is that because there's the serial meetings part of it, if you get three of you together and talk about something, you're putting a lot of trust in the other two that that they don't inadvertently have a conversation with a fourth person, and now those other two that didn't know are involved in that violation. So even a one-on-one conversation, I think, has that danger because you're putting trust in that other person that they aren't going to. And I don't think any of this is intended usually to violate public meetings. I think it just happens. And so we definitely caution against the use of email to other planning commissioners on a one-on-one basis, or copying everybody on a reply that's just to staff, because that can inadvertently set you up for a public meetings violation if you aren't super careful about who's involved in a conversation. The goal is really to have all of the business of the Planning Commission done publicly. So all of the, all of your deliberations and deciding towards decisions should happen in a work session or in a regular session.
Q&A between staff and a planning commissioner. If you've got a question about a particular topic or you need some additional understanding about what is in a document, communicating with staff typically is a fine thing to do.
Yes, yeah.
It's just the communication between each other outside of the public venue or a public meeting.
And the Court of Appeals decision, which is still being, it's still under review,
yes.
And this process might change because it went up to the Oregon Supreme Court. The Oregon Supreme Court said you don't actually have all the evidence. We're not going to decide whether your take on serial meetings is right or not, but you don't have all the evidence that you thought you did to show serial meetings, so you've got to go back and tease out that evidence. And so we still don't quite know how this area of law is going to shake out, but for the time being, serial communications could even happen through city staff. So if Greg James emails Brenda and says, my opinion is XYZ and I would like you to send that out to everyone and let them know before the meeting, and she does that, and then Grace emails back and CCs Tim and Sean and says, my opinion on that is this. Well, now, per the Court of Appeals, that's, Greg's opinion was passed through Brenda to three other planning commissioners, and that could be a public meetings violation. So what should happen is if you have information or you want information, staff can share information out, and they can share information out with all of you at the same time, like your packet. That's fine. That's not a problem. But if you share information back to staff, or you have questions you want answered, or you have opinions you want to share, then staff can collect those and then distribute them at the public meeting. And then as staff and the city attorney's office, we can act to make sure that we're not sharing opinions outward in a way that sets you up for a public meetings violation. Public records is a related topic to public meetings. So when we're communicating via email or packet materials, those are all public records. Anything that is produced by a public body, that's documents or recordings or the tangible things, voicemails don't count, but nearly everything else does. Those are text messages, for example. Those are all public records, no matter if they're stored on a public computer system or not. So if you are using a personal Gmail account to send emails related to Planning Commission, then your Gmail account is now holds public records and could be subpoenaed by a court or by the district attorney if there was a public records request. And you could have to turn over access to your private server or your work email, for example, if you have commission-related emails there. And the court or the district attorney would be able to look through everything to figure out what's a public record in that account. So that's the reason that we give you Springfield email addresses, so that they're segregated. And then the city also takes the responsibility then of storing them. So public records have to be stored according to a very specific retention schedule. And so if we're on the city system, then the city IT automatically assists with the archives and assists with that retention. If you're on your private Gmail or a work-related email address, then it's on you to make sure that that's happening. And again, though, you know, your home computer system, if you're using a private email account, then that could be discoverable in court if we got into a litigation.
Question for you.
Yeah.
So is it okay for staff to communicate out things to a private email as well as the public email, like a CC?
It's
like an agenda?
Yeah. I think Brenda right now does have some of you getting copies of things at two addresses, and that's your own, I think that's your own personal decision, but you should know that that email account that's not the city one that you're receiving stuff at, that's now vulnerable to being turned over to the district attorney or to the court if there's litigation. The fact that we say we've CC'd, you know, that we have a practice of always CC'ing your city account, or you say you have, or if you have a practice of always CC'ing yourself when you send stuff back from that, wouldn't, I don't think, shield you from having to turn that over in the event of a lawsuit or a public records request where we had to get into that level. Certainly we would argue that it would be needed, but I don't think that argument would be successful. So you should just know that if you're using two email addresses, that's probably not shielding you from having to turn stuff over. There are certain public records that are exempt from disclosure, but very few of these are going to be related to the Planning Commission. These are mostly employee discipline records, people's personal information, medical records. You know, the answers to state license exams are not disclosable public records. So there's a full list of exemptions in the statutes, and the materials go through those a little bit more. But for the purposes of the Planning Commission, very little that you do or talk about would be exempt. So anytime you send an email, you want to think, the test that I always have, even though I have attorney-client privilege, in every email I send, I'm thinking, if this was published on the front page of the Register Guard, how would I feel? I think that's kind of the standard that we should be thinking about when we do public business and create public records. And then the other key topic to be aware of as planning commissioners are ex parte communications. And in the quasi-judicial context, so these are typically your discretionary use approvals or your zone change metro plan amendments that affect one specific property. Ex parte contacts are conversations with the applicant or an interested person about an application that occur outside the public meeting. And so in order to cure those and make sure that all the information, everybody has the same information in making a quasi-judicial decision, you always need to declare those before the meeting and offer an opportunity for the applicant or the other side to rebut that evidence. And so we always prompt you to do that. I think you've all been good at that, but that's a reminder there. And then I'm happy to answer questions or talk about any topics that you want to go into more depth.
Well, one thing that I think is that I've gained some understanding around during my 7 years on the Planning Commission is the public meeting process, and that is to say the record is opened and, you know, the hearing is opened and we basically take information in. We don't necessarily deliberate because we are kind of here to be, not that we don't have opinions, but we're here to be an impartial, especially in a quasi-judicial situation, an impartial party taking in the information and then providing a decision or a recommendation. And so the move from the hearing to the hearing being closed and moving into deliberation, that piece is aligned, really is, because we often during public testimony at times get into some opinionated discussions around the testimony that we receive, and I don't think that it can't happen, but I think we need to be aware of our role, and when we move into deliberations, certainly that is when we can basically express our opinions in relation to the testimony and the public record information that's been submitted to us. So I think that is, to me, is something that has taken time to fully understand. And so I think it's important for us as commissioners to be aware of that, be aware of our role during the hearing and, you know, while the record is open and how we can gather the information we need to make an informed decision with staff or otherwise, and how staff can communicate that back to the commission in a way that is in alignment with public records law, but gets us the information we need when we do move into deliberations, that we have that information and that we can express our opinions and hopefully come to consensus around direction. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that or say anything about that. But
I would say that the only thing I would add is that impartiality, that right, essentially the applicant's right to an impartial decision maker and the public's right to an impartial decision maker is constitutionally protected. And so that's someplace that the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals and the courts will look at, you know, you're right, the public's right to have you act impartially. They'll look at that with more scrutiny than potentially other minor procedural errors that we might make along the way. So it is important. And I would also say, in the legislative context, it's not as important. But you know, there was, before I left on maternity leave, there was some pretty impassioned citizens who testified before joint hearings, and the other commission. There was at least one member of the other commission that was directly responding to some of that impassioned testimony with their own impassioned response, and I think that creates. You know, there are public perception issues around that type of engagement, but I think you also create more risk of appeals just out of a lack of sort of engaging the public in the right way. Like you create an incentive for somebody to appeal a decision that they're not satisfied with on an emotional level. I don't think we need to be as concerned about people appealing, you know, our decisions. Like, I don't want you to be afraid to make your decisions because you're afraid of an appeal. You know, that's not what I'm trying to say, but I think it makes sense to be careful in how you interact with the public during public hearings so that you're not alienating members of the public in that way.
Could I ask you a question? So when does an opinion cross the line into a bias? Is there a yardstick for that? I mean, would a bias be something where you have an opinion that can't be reversed with evidence to the contrary or something like that?
The standard that the court has said, which is not really, I think it would mean something different to each person, but the court has said, and it's in this packet, but there's two kinds of biases. There's a prejudgment as to what the outcome should be, and in the quasi-judicial sense, that's what they're saying is not allowed. You can't have already decided how you're going to vote on an application until you've heard all the evidence.
Okay.
Certainly, once you get a staff report and read the preliminary, you know, findings, you're going to have an idea.
Sure.
I think Greg touched on this when we met with Grace and did her training. You're going to have an idea of whether you think the criteria has been met or not, and the public testimony will add to that, but you shouldn't, from the outset, have decided that something will, you know. There's no way you're going to approve any new cell towers.
Regardless
of the criteria, you're anti-cell tower or you're anti-marijuana business or you're
right.
Anti-new church in a residential area. The other type of bias that's constitutionally protected against are conflicts of interest, but that falls under the conflict of interest rules then.
Yes.
You just mentioned something that brought up a question in my mind in reference to the conduct of a commissioner, an outside body, and a joint meeting.
Yeah.
Now, you, as the representative of the city of Springfield, you do have oversight over all legal aspects of a meeting, regardless of whether it pertains to the Springfield Commission or Lane County Commission as well. In other words, you can legally caution someone from an outside body if they're part of a meeting in which you're overseeing. Is that correct?
Well,
in other words, if somebody is stepping out of bounds, but they're
they have
Lane County Commission, then you can control that, right?
Well, no, not really. I mean, we try to stay on the same page as the county, but the county has their own county council.
And they're in their own hearing.
They open their own hearing. They have their own record. And so I don't think it's been the practice or custom, at least, on the part of their council to instruct you guys as to what you should or shouldn't be doing, or us to instruct their commissioners on what they should or shouldn't be doing. We try to be collaborative, definitely, and we try to make sure that we're if we think that their commission is doing something that undermines the entire process because our amendments aren't valid unless they co-adopt and vice versa, we try to work with county council to say we think we need to do these notices differently or, you know, those kinds of things. But that doesn't usually happen in the meeting.
I didn't even realize in our joint meetings that Lane County had legal counsel present.
They don't always.
They don't.
But that's, I think that's their
but
you know,
they
decision.
Have.
Yeah. And they have made part of that, I think, is that they have made a decision that the legal rights that we read in advance are sufficient for their purposes, and so they defer to us on that. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that the city attorney's office, I would personally not feel comfortable telling them you've not declared your ex parte contacts correctly, or asking them to do that if they weren't already going to.
That's interesting because the particular joint meeting we were having was really a Springfield-initiated plan. So they were participating because of the difference between the city boundary and the urban growth boundary. So it was kind of, we were kind of leading the process, weren't we?
Yeah, and I think the county on those types of things defers a lot to the city because, we are essentially the ones with the vested. It's our community that really has the vested stake, and then they have to, a lot of times I think they view it as they're protecting their residents in the UTA, but it's sort of ultimately Springfield's direction in where to go.
And would that be vice versa then if they initiated a meeting that we were jointly assisting in?
I don't think there has been one of those in the time from my externship, even before that I was, I don't know how often that they initiate stuff. Because of our IGA with them, then most of the planning, at least the planning related stuff, really starts with the city. They don't take on a lot of initiative to start things.
There's been one that I remember.
In all three jurisdictions.
It's when we had the groundwater issue.
Yes.
So Lane County initiated.
So sometimes they do send their legal counsel, and sometimes they don't. But and you're worried that we didn't stop the meeting.
Well, no, it just came to my mind through her conversation. Okay. It isn't something I was really worried about because obviously I'm not making the decision on.
Well, in that case, it's legislative. I mean, that's not really a legal issue. It's just more of a, I think, in terms of best practices, I would urge you to keep that. Professionalism and impartiality that in my all of my experience you've always shown.
I think it's difficult for a person who's been appointed to represent the city or the county consistent with the charter of both that, and then with the guidance that the governing body provides for them in trying to, you know, wrestle with difficult questions. And the co-jurisdiction that exists down here on certain matters is a particularly sensitive one because of the true effect that's being proposed by the action. And who's going to be impacted on that? Obviously, both Eugene and Lane County would have an underlying but unofficial principle of deference because it's our proposal. But clearly, if it affects their constituents, or if it's a matter that since they're using the same criteria on these things that we're using, and if a member of the other planning commission doesn't believe that the criteria has been met on something, I think it is reasonable for that person to say, if I'm required to make a decision on this, that's a decision in the interest of our co-governance, then I'm not going to remain silent on something that I don't feel has been satisfied. Or at most, they would voice that in the vote. And we have had votes that have been split before. We haven't always had unanimity. And in the past, we've even had, ironically enough, our planning commission voting no on a proposal inside the Springfield city limits. This is in the old day. And the Lane County and Eugene Planning Commission is voting yes on it. And it was an application that originated from a property owner in Springfield. So
we don't have that system of the Metro Plan anymore. So that's
a,
come right.
But that, I mean, that's a classic circumstance where both of the other planning commissions weren't convinced of this application. Or, I mean, they were convinced, I'm sorry. And our planning commission wasn't. Then it went to the elected officials, and it was 2 of the 3 agreed, so it had to go into a mediated process. And then it finally was approved. But that particular case inspired the first actual action to have some autonomy within the city limits. That was back in the early 90s. So,
Was that the the West Eugene Parkway with the wetlands out there?
No. This was that was
TSP.
Yeah, this was a property on Main Street in Springfield in the 3,000 block, and it it was there were conflicts of principle with respect to the plan designation staying industrial. And the Springfield Planning Commission believed it should. And it was in the context of all of the surrounding properties and a recent analysis of that particular piece of property being a high quality industrial development site. And so our planning commission said no. The Eugene and Lane County Planning Commissions said yes because it was a proposal for affordable housing,
yes,
which was of high interest to them.
Yeah.
And we were dealing with a single inventory back then. So even
though
it was in Springfield's jurisdiction, it reflected a land use activity that was impacting the entire
metro area.
Right. So it... Interesting dynamics in place there.
Yeah,
there was a period of time in the late 80s and early 90s where there was absolutely no certainty walking into the door of that council chambers what was going to happen that night. It was real exciting, I tell you. Real exciting.
Any other questions for Christina?
Yeah.
Yes, Taylor.
Just as a comment rather than a question, I think over an extended period of time that I've been involved in this, as Greg has, I've kind of found and I realize there's different people that have been doing the conversations, but I realize that the requirements, the rules and the regulations have been pretty much static, but the interpretations have been somewhat fluid. And so there are times where sometimes there's contradictions in statements that are made, and so I've kind of gotten to a point, I have had for a long time a list of unanswered planning related questions, and I'm realizing over time that I am not going to email questions to staff just because of the gray area that's involved.
You can always send emails to staff. Just don't.
Well, what my tendency has been lately, and I think everyone's noticed that, is when we reach the comment period of our meetings, well, then I'll drag a question out of storage and toss it out. So, well, there's the opportunity that I'm taking advantage of, rather than going through the email process and saying, well, maybe I can, maybe I can't, so on and so forth. So that's kind of been my tendency on over the last few years of addressing various issues.
I'd also say that a lot of the stuff, it might seem like it's static, but a lot of the stuff is very fluid. So LUBA is always coming out with they reverse themselves. Yeah. And so I think that we're always trying to be consistent with the latest thing that LUBA has said. We're certainly not trying to be inconsistent in the advice or the interpretation that we give. It's just that every case that LUBA comes out with, they shed a new light on something.
Yeah, there's always surprises. I noticed that. I mean, we've observed the LUBA process in a couple of instances over the years, and I know staff say, well, we've got all our bases covered, but there's always some kind of quirk that seems to suddenly come to light saying, oh, we didn't expect that, so I guess we have to deal with it. So, yeah, LUBA is a little bit...
One of the things that was really helpful to me when I was a young commissioner was your list of, I don't know if I ever was a young commissioner, your list of acronyms. I think about our newest commissioner, and she probably has a lot of background and understanding of this, but I mean, these guys throw out acronyms like they're, it's just, it's incredible. So, I don't know if she's been provided that, but that's really helpful just to know. What some of those acronyms are and how they, so that might even be a sidebar.
LUBA is the Land Use Board of Appeals for anyone that's not.
Well, the other thing is a lot of these bodies, they change their names periodically, so then you got the acronym down and all of a sudden it doesn't apply anymore.
So anyway. Okay?
U of O is the worst.
Well, HACCSA isn't HACCSA anymore, so that's one of these.
Good.
Yeah.
I think City of Eugene's got Springfield.
I think I gave you all a list of acronyms, and there have been some that have been added. But if you run into some, just email me.
I've got a whole page of them in here.
Yeah.
And that's even not even including some of them, because I don't think of them to write them down when I hear them.
It was something JT, if you remember John Tamulonis when he worked here, it was one of the first things he gave me and said, you're going to need this. And so I passed that along.
Yeah. Yeah. Had to file something called a budget adjustment request form, a BARF.
Okay.
Usually misunderstood.
Yeah. All right. We, if you have no further questions.
I just have one more thing. If you have a question about the ethics law or public meetings, public records, please do email us. And please email us before you've taken the action or you've done the thing that you're not sure about. Because we want to be in a position to help you proactively rather than to tell you if you've already messed up. And it's always fine to email the city attorney or email staff. Again, please don't CC, but... That's the only caveat on communicating to us. We will not get you in trouble in the way that we respond.
Perfect. Okay. Well, we don't have a plaque for Greg.
When's your last
day? The 20th.